I next met with Dr. Raul Tibbs from the Mayo Clinic to review a number of cases from his practice, but as we sat down, he told me about another patient who'd come in emergently the night before our interview.
A 54-year-old female who had induction and spring consolidation. She was en route to transplant. There was some donor search issues and some insurance approval. Then she unfortunately relapsed sometime in July, had salvage with another regimen, MEC chemotherapy salvage, had a second remission, which was very short-lived, and yesterday afternoon she came to the emergency room with a white count of close to 100,000, 98% blasts, platelets 8,000, and fulminant relapse of her AML. So her second relapse, so to speak, within only 6 months.
So this woman coming in just last night, I'm sure this is really on your mind right now. What are you thinking?
Well, what's on my mind is, what other therapies can we offer this woman? Because if an acute myeloid leukemia, and she had actually diploid cytogenetics, she was diagnosed at the outside first and then came to us for consolidation after her initial induction. And we knew that she was NPM1 positive, but there was no reported FLT3, FLT3 status from the outside hospital. And since she was in a remission initially when she came, it was difficult to repeat that. You can add FLT3 testing on the outside slides and blocks, but it wasn't difficult to obtain those. So essentially, when she came in yesterday, of course, we stabilized her, we hydrated her, we gave her allopurinol, and then we initiated plasmapheresis, leukapheresis last night still to take, because she had early signs of leukostasis. We don't do leukapheresis often, but she was with a 98% blast and a white count of 100,000. So we initiated leukapheresis, initiated hydroxyurea, 1 gram, Q8 hours, and admitted her to the inpatient service, as well as ordering a bone marrow biopsy for today, as well as send off a flow cytometry from the peripheral blood. I mean, we knew it was blast, it was a relapsed AML, but we still wanted to confirm a myeloid phenotype. And the other thing is, we are also sending a FLT3 mutation testing. And why were we sending this? Because it does make a difference. FLT3 is one of the most commonly mutated genes in AML in general, particularly in diploid cytogenetics or normal karyotype. You find in up to 25 to 30% of the patients, either with NPM1 positivity or without. So often you do find NPM1 and FLT3 together. And we didn't have the original specimen. As I said, she was diagnosed as an outside facility. And often patients with a FLT3 positive AML, they often have leukocytosis and a very high white blood cell count. So when I see a patient, when I teach the fellows on the service, and then we have a leukemia with a white count of 150,000, it immediately rings the bell, could this be a FLT3 positive leukemia? Why is this important? Because particularly in a patient where we're running out of salvage options, 2 relapses within 6 months, she's essentially refractory to chemotherapy. And there are several FLT3 inhibitors currently in clinical trials. And there's first and second generation FLT3 inhibitors. And they have shown overall, I would say, rather good to encouraging response rates. Depending on which FLT3 inhibitor, you have a response rate defined as a CR, which is a complete remission, or CRI, incomplete count recovery, which is still useful. So essentially achieving a remission in 40 to 50% of the patients. And that's across the different FLT3 inhibitors. None of those FLT3 inhibitors are approved yet for FDA usage. However, there are large clinical trials ongoing. And I do think patients with a FLT3 mutations, particularly at relapse, but also in the upfront setting, should be offered a FLT3 inhibitor on a clinical trial if one is available.
So if I could ask you a few questions about what you just said. First, getting back to this patient, how exactly is the FLT3 assay done, the one that you just sent on her? And how long is it going to take to get back?
At the initial diagnosis, we send it from the bone marrow biopsy often. However, you can also send, if you have a significant peripheral blast percentage, you can send it also from the peripheral blood. The turnaround time varies if your hospital, if your center offers it, or if it's a send-out test. Some centers can turn it around within 1 or 2 days, but it shouldn't take more than 2 to 5 days, so a few days. And it's very important and vital information. So it's an easy, reliable test, and it helps in management of patients.
If her FLT3 test, as you maybe are somewhat suspecting, comes back positive, you said that none of the FLT3 inhibitors are approved, but I mean, sorafenib is approved. So first of all, would you consider sorafenib? And second of all, what are the agents that you would like to see her get on if you could?
Yeah.
Obviously, there's gilteritinib, there's midostaurin.
Yeah, very good question. Sorafenib is approved for other indications for solid tumors, HCC or renal cell carcinoma. And actually, I have used it in patients with FLT3-positive AML off-label. And there is data from clinical trials from various institutions using sorafenib in addition to standard chemotherapy. There were studies from the MD Anderson. There were studies from the German leukemia group. And the response rates in FLT3-positive patients when sorafenib is added approaches 90-95% to close to 100%, the initial CR rates. The overall survival and the relapse rates were not that different. So it does make a difference adding sorafenib to chemotherapy, achieving remissions. There may be a benefit if you continue sorafenib because the initial trials did not continue it for longer term. So continuing the FLT3 inhibitor after the induction consolidation, I think it's one approach. Also, how you sequence it.
So sort of a maintenance kind of strategy.
Correct, a maintenance. So adding it to induction and then a maintenance strategy. Sorafenib also has been given their phase 2 study data with azacitidine, for example. So I have used it several times in older patients that are not induction candidates because of age, because of comorbidities or preferences of the patients. So I have given sorafenib with azacitidine off-label and have seen good responses. And if there's phase 2 data, a blood paper, and some other papers published, so in the community, it's sometimes important to have this information available for insurance approval. So there's data out there. That's just the message I want to send out to my colleagues.
At this point, how do you differentiate the various FLT3 inhibitors that have been studied? You mentioned sorafenib, midostaurin, gilteritinib. I think there are probably others.
Yes.
How do you separate them out at this point?
So that's a good question. Sorafenib is kind of a dirty FLT3 inhibitor or not as potent against FLT3 because it inhibits other tyrosine kinases as well. Midostaurin as well. Initially, it wasn't developed as a FLT3 inhibitor, but now it also has FLT3 inhibitory activity. So midostaurin was used in a randomized phase 3 trial, which was presented at last year's ASH meeting, which actually showed an overall survival benefit if midostaurin was added to upfront induction chemotherapy. There was a huge effort in an international study, and that was the first positive study adding a FLT3 inhibitor to induction chemotherapy showing an overall survival benefit. It is not approved yet, but definitely the data was positive. So there are other FLT3 inhibitors. Another one I have been involved personally, and we presented data in clinical abstracts, is ASP2215 or gilteritinib. It was in a phase 1-2 study, and that's public data, so I can talk about it. So we presented it at various meetings, including ASH and ASCO, and we have treated more than 200 patients with that medication as a single agent. And the response rates, again, CR, CRI, were in the range of 40 to 50%. And many of the patients actually had maintained responses when they were continued on this medication. Because one challenge is achieving a remission, and the other challenge is maintaining a remission.
You know, in this era where we're just starting to get single-arm studies, how do you indirectly compare these agents, not only in terms of efficacy, but any tolerability differences?
That's a good question. I think we cannot really compare different medications and different compounds across studies. That's why I always highlight the general response rate for those medications. So, for example, for the FLT3 inhibitor, single agent for the first or second generation, sorafenib is a dirty one, midostaurin is a good one, but also a dirty kinase inhibitor, which has shown this overall survival benefit in a phase 3 trial. We have crizartinib or AC220, which also has shown in phase 2 studies and now is in phase 3 studies as single agent or in chemotherapy combinations. Also, our CR, CRI rates, meaning achieving a remission in the range of 40 to 50%. The responses in the single agent in the earlier FLT3 inhibitors were often short-lived, 6 to 9 months. So what we have reported with gilteritinib is that the responses may last a little longer than the first-generation FLT3 inhibitors. I think another important point to make for every oncologist is there are two mutations in FLT3. One is the FLT3 ITD, which is the internal tandem duplication. And there's another mutation, the FLT3 TKD, or the tyrosine kinase domain mutation. So the ITD is the more common one, and the TKD, the classical tyrosine kinase domain mutation, is less common. It's important because not every FLT3 inhibitor is active against both. So I've seen patients that had both a FLT3 ITD and TKD, and I have seen patients that only had the TKD. For example, sorafenib or quizartinib, they're not active against the TKD. So it does make a difference to test for both mutations, which most labs do. And then if you have the option of putting the patient on a trial, or at some point if we have these medications available, distinguishing those two FLT3 mutations.
I'm going to clarify one thing, though, with this patient who came in last night. Mm-hmm. She initially was treated in a community setting.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. One of the issues that comes up, of course, is the issue of whether the patient should be treated in a community setting or in a tertiary care setting. And, you know, one of the questions that we hear a lot from the community-based docs revolves around, you know, what standard assay? So, for example, should this patient have had FLT3 testing right up front? And at a tertiary center, they might get all kinds of multiplex testing, et cetera. But what's the baseline of what you have to have in order to treat a patient in the community?
So there are guidelines, and I can tell you how I practice and what my approach is. And I will tell you why. So the baseline is, after the diagnosis of leukemia, for sure, cytogenetics, conventional cytogenetics, or FISH, an AML-specific FISH. And for diplet cytogenetic patients, meaning a normal karyotype, doing NPM1 and FLT3 mutation. So that's the common standard. However, there are other subgroups, including the favorable risk leukemias, that's the translocation 821 or the inversion 16, where quite a number of patients, up to 10-20%, also have other mutations, including FLT3. So I had a few patients, younger patients in the 30s or 40s with favorable karyotype AML, that's the A21, and another patient with a version 16, and they actually did have a FLT3 mutation and the FLT3 TKD mutation. And those patients actually have an intermediate prognosis, so they're not that favorable anymore. They're not doing as poorly as an unfavorable karyotype or diplet karyotype with a FLT3. However, those patients, I have seen them relapse if they had a FLT3 mutation, particularly the TKD. So we also make an individual decision on those patients, and we send them to transplant sometimes based on the donor status and based on the tolerance and based on the response. So I would advocate to do FLT3 testing for most patients upfront. Why? Because we also have a drug available, or we do have therapies available. So I do think it makes a difference. I'm not advocating for testing everything, but if we have medications available, now, targeted therapies, I do think it makes a difference, and I would test for those.
Let's finish out this discussion about AML by hearing about your 56-year-old patient.
So we have a 56-year-old patient, which is quite remarkable, one of the first patients that was one of the FLT3 inhibitor trials. So she came in initially, the diplet cytogenetics, NPM1, FLT3 were negative, so kind of an intermediate risk group. She received an induction with 7+3 standard at the higher dose of daunorubicin, 90 milligrams per meter square, then consolidation with high dose RSC for 3 cycles. A discussion of transplant were initiated at that point, but she deferred because of various circumstances. So you can transplant those patients, you don't have to. Unfortunately, the patient relapsed roughly 2.5 years after her initial remission, and she developed a new cytogenetic abnormalities, a 7q deletion. So that's also important, I think. I do repeat the cytogenetics and patients that relapse, because there is clonal evolution, meaning new clones coming out and leading to relapse. She received salvage, reinduction salvage, and at this point, one of her sisters was a donor. She achieved a second remission and went to an allogeneic stem cell transplantation. She was doing well again for 2.5 to 3 years, and then unfortunately relapsed again. So now we have a patient that has the second relapse after transplant. So you could try another induction and another transplant. She had a fulminant relapse, so there was no time to give a DLI or donor lymphocyte infusion. So we discussed reinduction, possibly another transplant. She did not want that option. And at that point, we repeated the cytogenetics, as I mentioned, as well as repeated the FLT3 testing. And I do think it's important, because there are some emerging data that the incidence of lithotripsy mutations can actually increase upon relapse. Or if a patient is initially negative, patients can become positive for FLT3. So I do repeat FLT3 testing upon relapse in most of my patients. So she now had become FLT3 positive, and we put her on a clinical trial with an investigational FLT3 inhibitor.
Did she have a prior FLT3 assay?
She did have one at the initial diagnosis, which was...
she went from negative to positive.
She went from negative to positive.
And what type of FLT3 alteration specifically did she have?
She actually had an ITD and TKD. It's rare, but she had both of those mutations together.
And you say she went on a clinical trial. What agent did she receive?
Gilteranib.
So she was one of these 200 patients you were just talking about?
She was one of the first patients in our center, but she was one of the patients on trial. She achieved a CRI. So after the first or second month's CR, her counts never completely recovered, but her ANC was around 1, 1.5. Platelets were in the 40 to 60 range. And we have seen those as well. We have seen patients that have a clinical benefit and stay in remission but do not fully recover a count. Keep in mind, she was heavily pretreatment post-transplant, so it could be the drug, but it could also be a heavy pretreatment. And she actually is doing fine now, 14 months after starting on therapy or on trial.
So she's still on gilteritinib?
She's still, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Any tolerability issues at all?
This myelosuppression, which we quite don't know if this is drug-associated, but we do have to call it drug-associated, but it's tolerable. It's not impairing her quality of life.
So quality of life-wise, she feels good?
She feels good. She has occasional fatigue. She did have one episode of pneumonia. At some point, we dose-reduced medication, and since then, she has been doing well.
Yeah, I'm thinking about that first patient, the one you saw last night, the fact that she didn't have FLT3 testing when she was diagnosed, hearing about your patient who goes from negative to positive and now is in CR. I mean, that's
amazing. Huh? That's amazing. Yeah, I know.
Yeah, it's got a little education implication, too, that we could talk about. But why don't we move on and talk a little bit about CML? And maybe you could talk about your 36-year-old man.
So, I mean, CML is a disease that can occur at essentially any age. I've seen it in the late 20s, mid-30s to 70s. And a recent case I saw was a 36-year-old young male. He was in perfect normal health, very athletic. And then he noticed for the last couple of months, increasing fatigue and shortness of breath after playing soccer. And he was a soccer coach as well. And he was playing soccer himself, and he didn't think too much about it because he never had any medical issues or problems. And he went to his primary care physician, and he was found to have a white count in the range of 58,000. With a left shift, myelocytes, metamyelocytes, was mildly anemic with a hemoglobin of 11.8, normal platelets. And of course, this, you know, he was immediately referred to hematology, and primary care physicians may not be that familiar with CML. So when I saw the patient or the outside labs for referral, I saw him the next day, and it obviously rings a bell for CML. So when he came to see me, we sent FISH for the BCR-ABL translocation 922 from the peripheral blood immediately, scheduled a bone marrow biopsy for a day or 2 days later. We started the patient on hydroxyurea, allopurinol. His renal function was normal. And a few days later, we received the results that indeed this is a BCR-ABL or 9 translocation. The bone marrow biopsy was done, and I do a bone marrow biopsy on all my newly diagnosed CML patients because I want to know the status, if it's truly CML in chronic phase. So he didn't have any blasts in the peripheral blood, just the left shift, and no increased blasts in the bone marrow either. And I do send conventional cytogenetics on all my patients because it may make a difference if you have additional cytogenetic abnormalities in addition to the BCR-ABL or the 922 translocations. So fortunately, this gentleman did not have any additional karyotypic abnormalities. And then the question is, how do you treat him?
Could I ask how long ago this was?
This was 2 months, 2-3 months.
Oh, just a couple months ago.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Okay. So could you talk a little bit about what you would consider potential alternatives for him and how you thought it through?
Yeah. So, I mean, he's a young gentleman. He still wants to have a family. So obviously, once we establish the diagnosis of CML in chronic phase, that's important. So we go down the route of treating him with a BCR-ABL-specific tyrosine kinase inhibitor. So we have imatinib as the first generation and the first one approved. We have nilotinib, dasatinib as the second generation ones. Then we have bosutinib. We also have ponatinib in the third line treatment setting. So for The upfront treatment for CML in chronic phase, one can use imatinib or one of the second generation nilotinib or dasatinib. So I think all the options are valid and they're all recommended by guidelines.
So I'm curious with this man, the kind of discussion that you had with him, what were the things that he was asking? Mm-hmm. How involved was he in making the final decision? And what did you two decide to do?
Yeah. So I think, first of all, I explained the disease to him. I explained that at this stage, the recommended therapy is a BCR-ABL TKI, and we're not proceeding to transplant unless he was in an accelerated phase or in blastic phase, obviously. So then I discussed the data with him fairly openly that we do see higher molecular remission rate and faster with the second generation TKI, so nilotinib and dasatinib, but imatinib somewhat catches up later in the time course. I'm of the opinion that the earlier and the harder we hit the disease or the cancer, the better it is, because most data has shown this for most diseases. So you have to hit early and hard. So I usually start with the second generation TKIs unless there are contraindications, side effects, or approval concerns.
Which one?
I discussed the options of treatment, second generation TKI versus imatinib, and we opted to start him on nilotinib. And with the prospect that at some point he may also enroll in a clinical trial after a couple of years of a deep molecular remission, an MMR 4.5, and then he may have the option to go on a trial if there's still a trial available at that point, and then discontinue on a trial. I do know about trials that try to add interferon at some point or interferon after discontinuation to try to maintain the response, because interferon has been used prior to the BCR-ABL TKIs and was an effective therapy. And interferon has an immune modulatory function. And in the initial trials, patients that did receive interferon actually may have had a longer treatment-free remission interval. That's a new term that's been formulated recently. So essentially, how long can you keep a patient off a TKI in remission?
Let's talk a little bit about myeloproliferative neoplasms. Can you talk a little bit about how you think through the issue of JAK inhibitors, specifically ruxolitinib, in myeloproliferative neoplasms?
So JAK2 inhibitors are approved for myelofibrosis based on their symptom control, as well as now in the second line setting after hydroxyurea failure or intolerance for PV patients. So the way I use JAK inhibitors is for intermediate to and high risk patients if they are symptomatic, according to the DIPSS or DIPSS Plus prognostic scoring system. Those are scoring systems that essentially take several factors into account, build a risk score, so similar to the IPSS for MDS. But I let myself also guide mostly along the lines of, does the patient have symptoms? Does the patient have cachexia? Does he have splenomegaly? Does he have weight loss, night sweats, and so forth? So JAK2 inhibitors are very good at controlling symptoms in MPNs. They do also control the leukocytosis as well as erythrocytosis, so increased counts they can control as well. So if a patient has a higher, intermediate or higher risk myelofibrosis, is symptomatic, I would start a patient on a JAK2 inhibitor. Currently, ruxolitinib is approved.
What about patients who, say, respond to ruxolitinib but then have, you know, symptomatic progression? Do other JAK inhibitors work? Are there other agents you can use?
Yeah, so there are several agents that are in clinical trials after ruxolitinib progression. So upon ruxolitinib progression, first of all, I always see what dose is the patient on. Is there still some room to increase the dose of ruxolitinib? If this has been maximized and if there's clear progression, I do want to know if there's a progression into a more accelerated phase of the myelofibrosis or even into blast phase, because that may change my approach. If a patient is young, has a true acceleration and progression of the disease, or younger, at that point we would send him for evaluation for an allogeneic stem cell transplantation. All of those transplants are difficult in myelofibrosis patients.
So again, a couple cases sent in to us. I'm curious what you think. 68-year-old man diagnosed with symptomatic primary myelofibrosis but has a platelet count of 38,000. The doc wants to use ruxolitinib, wants to know about the dose, or maybe even whether to use it.
Yeah. So ruxolitinib initially in the initial trials patients have to have normal or higher platelet counts above 100,000. There's in the package label, in the package insert, you can use it at lower platelet counts, but you do need to reduce the dose of ruxolitinib. Below 50,000, some would still start it, but many physicians probably would not initiate it.
What would you do?
Well, there are clinical trials. Some of them are on hold right now. So not every JAK inhibitor has the same side effect profile. So there are some, for example, pacritinib has not shown as much cytopenias. And there's a trial, the PERSIST-1, PERSIST-2 trials that are currently on hold by the FDA. And those were geared towards patients with lower platelet counts. There's momelotinib, which is also in phase 3 trials, which also doesn't seem to have cytopenias that much as a side effect and actually may have a beneficial effect on the hemoglobin and improve the anemia. So if there's a trial available, I would consider a trial, referring the patient to a center with a clinical trial. For a platelet of 38,000, is there anything else that can explain the platelet count? Are there any medications? Is there anything else? Would it be worthwhile to repeat a bone marrow biopsy? Is there maybe a more accelerated phase that may necessitate, transplant evaluation? Would I start it? Maybe. Then at a very low dose for symptomatic control, 5 milligrams once daily, maybe, and then even twice daily. So very low dose, maybe even alternating days, 5 once or twice a day. So it's kind of a balance, and it's a kind of a gray zone. Should be careful because there are cytopenias, thrombocytopenias, anemia on ruxolitinib.
Another case from the community, 59-year-old man diagnosed with primary myelofibrosis when he presented with low-grade fever, night sweats, weight loss in the preceding 6 months, and pancytopenia. Physical exam, he had splenomegaly, 6 fingers below the costal margin, JAK2 V617 mutation positive. He was started on ruxolitinib 20 BID. During week 6, his hemoglobin started dropping. It went from 10.5 at the start of therapy down to 8.7. The patient's feeling better. His systemic symptoms have disappeared. His spleen is decreasing. How would you manage the patient's anemia? What about ESAs?
Yeah. So anemia is seen in roughly around 30% or plus of the patients with ruxolitinib. It seems that the patient has had a good response, symptomatic response to ruxolitinib. 20 milligrams BID, it's a good dose. So I probably would dose reduce the patient to 50 milligrams BID and maybe even 10 milligrams or 10 and 15 milligrams. So try to dose titrate down a little bit and see what the anemia does. And sometimes you do need, I have given patients transfusions in the first couple of months or half year, year. Because the anemia often, it doesn't get worse over time, and there's some data that it may actually get better and improve over time, or at least it doesn't get worse. So supporting the dose adjustment and supporting the patients with transfusions, I usually do not add ESAs.
Let's move on and talk a little bit about MDS.
Yeah.
And your 71-year-old man.
So we have a 71-year-old gentleman. Initially, 4 or 5 years ago, before we saw him, he was diagnosed with a low-grade MDS, then became increasingly anemic, and at some point, RBC, red blood cell transfusion dependency, had a low-risk IPSS of 0.5, with trisomy 8 at the initial presentation, and the patient was on erythropoietin initially. He responded for roughly 14 months and then became transfusion-dependent again. And then, because he was only partially spending the time here, and then he sought a clinical trial with oral azacitidine, which he was on for 12 months, not really in benefit or improvement of his anemia, but at least stable and maybe a little reduction in his RBC transfusion dependency.
Could I just ask you, before you go on with this case, what it was like when he was taking the oral azacitidine? How much of an improvement in quality of life did you see compared to patients who get it intravenously?
Yeah. Well, the oral azacitidine is not approved. So it's still investigational. There are phase 2 data, and now there's a phase 3 trial ongoing for MDS. He tolerated it well. His quality had remained stable or normal.
Is that a approach that you think is going to be useful in the future? I guess the thing I wonder about is whether or not by having an oral formulation, maybe people end up getting more drug.
I think we have to wait for the data. What you're asking is, what's the exposure time to a hypermethylating agent? And there are some studies, if you give it for prolonged periods of time, decitabine has been given for 10 days as opposed to 5 days. The way I see it is maybe a little longer exposure is good. If you give it continuously, it may not be better. So there may be a break point of how long to give it for. So essentially, this gentleman was doing well, then he was off any treatment for a year and a half, and then he became anemic again, pancytopenic, and came back and unfortunately progressed into higher risk MDS. Actually, and then at the first bone marrow biopsy at 8% blasts, repeated it a month or 2 months later, 12% blasts, and still the trisomy 8. And then he was evaluated for an allogeneic stem cell transplantation because he clearly shows progression of his MDS. And he's 71, although he's older, but there's no other curative option for this gentleman available. He did not want to have a stem cell transplant. So we discussed the options. He had been on oral azacitidine investigational 2 or 3 years earlier. So it would be worthwhile to go back on azacitidine, decitabine, sub-Q or intravenously. So we did treat him with a clinical trial of azacitidine, in this case adding an oral drug, a smoothen inhibitor, LDE-225 or sonidegib. And there are other trials out there. So my general thinking is if a patient has progressed or if a patient has received some kind of HMA before, you can switch to the other HMA, but the response rates are not that good. So somebody has been on azacitidine, progresses, switching to the decitabine, you see some responses, but they're not very good. So generally, I try to offer a combination of an HMA with a novel drug, with a targeted drug. So we treated him on this clinical trial for 6 cycles, and stable disease was the best response. So he didn't see any major improvements, but little benefit improvements in his counts, but not to the point where he had a remission. And after 12 cycles, unfortunately, he progressed into AML. At that point, he was 73 years old, and we discussed induction, transplant again. He didn't want to have this, and eventually he went comfort measures and comfort care.